Well, thank you very much, Sandy, for those very kind remarks. And just to put it in some context, the Red Sox won the World Series that year. I really, you know, I wasn't going to miss that. So, and besides the North Koreans, I mean, the only other response was to cup your ears and cry. So, well, what I thought I'd do today is maybe talk about all the troubles in the world. That shouldn't take long, but I do want to give a shout out to these fabulous student guests you had here today. I was amazed at their accomplishments. I mean, GPAs of 5. I didn't know you could go above 4, but anyway, it was truly, truly impressive, and, you know, you're going to have fabulous careers, and you'll come back here at some point, and you'll see other students like yourself, and you'll say, you know, a few years ago, I was just like you, so you stay with it. And I think just as in the Foreign Service or in any profession, your job is to sort of look after that successor generation following you. And indeed, I was just in Washington yesterday. Spent a year there last night. But I was one of the reasons I was there was to see a former special assistant of mine, a woman named Yuri Kim, and she was just sworn in her first ambassadorship, ambassador to Albania, which... you know, the old joke about being an ambassador, sort of like in medical school, no matter what you do, you're a doctor. And so she's ambassador. I'm very proud of her to achieve that. And very proud of the fact that I felt I helped her, and I can see her already turning around to help others. And that's really the way it goes with generations. We need to understand that we're united by this great cause in this country of ours. So... So before I turn to the issues of today, I always cite, for no particular reason, this former Polish party first secretary. You know, as many of you know, Poland was hopelessly under a communist regime until 1989. And this guy, Władysław Gomułka, a name otherwise lost to history, Władysław Gomułka was one of the worst of the Communist Party first secretaries, and he was known for very long speeches and not very successful metaphors. And one day he stood in front of a large crowd in the southern Polish city of actually Nowa Huta, or steelworks, and he said, "Comrades, just a few years ago, our fatherland stood on the very edge of a deep abyss. And I'm here to tell you today, comrades, that we have taken an important step forward." And so, with the thoughts of Władysław Gomułka in our minds, I thought perhaps I would talk about some of the issues that we face, issues that we need to understand better, issues that I think we need to be more thoughtful about at times. So why don't I start with Ambassador Sandy Rant's old haunts, that is China. There is no country more important to our country's future in the world than China. It doesn't mean we have to love everything about China. It doesn't mean we have to agree with everything the Chinese do. And in fact, I think we're going through some very tough times with China. China, anyone who's lived there, and by the way, no ambassador in the history of the United States of America has lived there as long as Sandy Rant lived there. And I don't think there's anyone who's lived there and has come away with the view that these are not a serious people. These are a very serious people and a very talented people. And I think we need to understand that they have some history there. And when they embraced communism, or when communism embraced them in the 1940s, it's a system really completely inappropriate to what their people have to offer. And so I think when the history books are finally written about China and when China does change, any changes that have happened in China has been a function of the people of China saying, communists, please get out of our way. You know, we'll live with the Red Stars, we'll live with the party first secretaries visiting our factories, but just get out of the way. That is really largely the story of China, of people trying to push that terrible system aside, because they know, even better than we know about China, the fact that that system of communist dictatorship does not comport with the talents and the aspirations of the people of China. How they fix it, how they deal with it, how they change it is really going to be something that is up to them in the future. But what is not up to them and what does need to be up to us is a need to kind of shape the environment in which China grows, because grow they will. It's a serious place. Now, Xi Jinping, the president of China, we had a lot of hopes for Xi Jinping. Not only that he traipsed around the rural areas of Iowa, most American presidents have done that, by the way, but Xi Jinping was a summer student in Iowa. He seemed to understand the United States. Not a lot of English, but he seemed to kind of understand what was going on. I remember Ambassador Rant and I attended a lunch with President Bush, and we were with then Vice President Xi Jinping, and we thought, wow, what a pleasure. He followed a guy named Hu Jintao, and President Hu Jintao was a guy really very much from the security services, not a word of any foreign language, and certainly hadn't spent a summer on a tractor in Iowa. So we thought, oh, we're going to be able to speak this guy's language. So Xi Jinping becomes president. What's one of the first things he does? He abolishes something that the Chinese had set up, probably the most successful aspect of an unsuccessful governance structure. They created essentially a term limit for the president. So two terms, you're out. And they knew their experiences in the past with Mao Zedong. They're certainly not ready for elections, but they understood they don't want someone there more than two terms. And so Xi Jinping went and changed that. And as shocking as it was to many China hands in this country saying, you know, that's big stuff when you go from a two-term leader to a president for life, that's big stuff and not very positive stuff. And by the way, we're not the only people who feel that way, because if you spend any time in China and you have friends there and they're prepared to make private comments to you, they're all very worried about it as well. China's not performing well. The economy has got a lot of problems. And frankly, there's more nationalism being brought to bear in that country than there was in the past. I thought that Xi Jinping was not the instigator of some of what they've been doing in the South China Sea, where they have essentially been laying claims to territory, which is historically perhaps from the Chinese world, but it's never been kind of laid out as part of the Chinese state. And there they are claiming territories that are very in the South China Sea. That is very worrisome to countries that are truly maritime powers, whether it's the Philippines or Vietnam, Malaysia, even Indonesia. They're very concerned about the way the Chinese have kind of laid claim to the South China Sea. And it's not just that they're making facts on the ground. They're actually making the ground itself. They're pouring dirt on top of atolls and otherwise militarizing and claiming these islands. This is a problem, and we need to be absolutely on top of this. Our Navy has from time to time put ships through there. We have essentially told the Chinese, we are a maritime power, we need to have right of access, and we're not going to accept these kinds of unilateral moves. The Chinese have sought to, and there's no other word for it, so I'll use the word bribe, these governments. They've tried to bribe the Duterte government in the Philippines to essentially allow them to grab these islands. They've gone to a kind of tough-minded policy with Japan, and don't believe that this all comes from the war years. This is China has very much instrumentalized the history with Japan. to try to claim these Senkaku Islands. And so they have been very rough on this, and we need to be very firm. And I think we are being firm on the South China Sea. Another area where we have to be firm is, of course, the area that many of you are very familiar with, and that's in the economic area. To use a term from the environmental movement, it is unsustainable to run the kind of surpluses that China has run with us and expect us to say, well, that's just economics. There's no role in economics textbooks for bilateral surpluses or deficits, so we're not going to worry about it. It doesn't really matter what a bilateral deficit is. We have to talk about broader balance of payments issues. Not true. When you have a lot of structural transformation in our country, when you have people losing their jobs, perhaps to automation, perhaps to the fact that Sri Lanka is online with a lot of textiles, nonetheless, China has become a symbol of job loss in America. And this is a problem that I think China has brought on itself by trying to sustain unsustainable trade surpluses with the U.S. So I think we need to understand we have a challenge here. And I have no problem with going after the Chinese on this issue. I have no problem with kind of telling the Chinese we won't tolerate it anymore. And I think our current president has been doing that. The issue, of course, is how you do it and whether you can kind of lay out a path for the other guy to follow. And you need to be clear. And when you take decisions, you need to be clear that those decisions will stand and you won't change them again. So again, we have to be, I think, very clear about laying out what the future course will be. And I think if we can do that, we will get some changes in China. I was in a recent conference in southern China in Hainan Island, which is an island down in the South China Sea, what the Chinese would like to think of as a southern Chinese lake, but it's a South China Sea. And I heard a number of Chinese officials saying, we need to take these steps not because of what the Americans tell us to do, but because they're the right steps for us. And frankly, they are the right steps for them. And whatever the reason for taking those steps, the Chinese do need to take those steps. They need to stop extracting technology from American corporations. They deny it, but they're doing it. They also need to understand that we cannot afford the kind of deficits we're running with China, and ultimately it's politically unsustainable in our country to do this. So I think the Chinese are coming around to the view that they'd better diversify their foreign trade. But when I say coming around, they're coming around to it very slowly. And right now we find that a lot of these issues, a lot of the kind of normal bilateral issues with China are being kind of sucked into these disagreements. And before you long, you seem to be having in this country a kind of sense that we have this country out there with whom we are in some kind of inevitable conflict. And that goes to these various academic theories of something called the Thucydides trap. Now, most people spent most of their years in life not knowing how to spell Thucydides, let alone understanding that Thucydides was a historian of some 2,300 years ago who tracked the rise of Sparta against Sparta's the rising power and Athens as the established power, and the fact that they eventually got into war, and that war lasted for 30 disastrous years for both countries. I don't think that is the inevitable course of U.S.-China relations. But we need to be careful that we do keep this relationship in a certain trajectory, and at the same time look for areas where we can work, where we can, in Condi Rice's term that she used many times with me, establish a kind of pattern of cooperation. Now, one area where I think the U.S. and China can do that is, if you step back, you'll notice a lot of American films these days have at the end of them kind of these funny endings where somehow China is working with the U.S. And you go, well, why is that happening? Because the political talk in the U.S. is quite different. There's a film called The Martian. and where the plot has a Mars probe, a U.S. Mars probe, having to leave Mars and leave stranded in Mars Matt Damon as the last remaining astronaut. And so it's unclear how they're ever going to pick up Matt Damon from Mars. And then along comes, in the last third of the movie, the Chinese have a spaceship where they're ready to go to Mars. And lo and behold, the Chinese come out of nowhere and rescue the day and rescue Matt Damon. Well, I would argue we don't need to go to Mars to find some patterns of cooperation with China. We don't need to rescue Matt Damon to do that. But we do need to talk about some areas where we do have, I think, serious problems in the region, and where the U.S. and China have a very similar outlook. And I would say one of those, one of the most important, is North Korea and its nuclear ambitions. Well, the North Koreans, having dealt with them for 4 years, they are a people only a mother can love. You just want to pick them up and hug them, And they have been at this business for since really the late 60s. If you go back to the Korean War, and real quick, you have the North Koreans invading South Korea on June 25th, 1950. You have the very few U.S. forces there, because remember what happened was at the end of World War II, the Russians were about to take the whole Korean Peninsula. The U.S. negotiated an arrangement where at the 38th parallel, which they just saw on a map and put a pencil line through it, 38th parallel, the U.S. would take the surrender of Russian forces south of the Korean Peninsula, and the Russians would take the, Japanese. U.S. would take the surrender of Japanese forces south of the Korean Peninsula. The U.S. would take, the Russians would take the Japanese surrender north of the 38th parallel. It was a demarcation for the purpose of figuring out who would take the surrender of Japanese forces. It became a border. It divided a peninsula. For people who had nothing to do with it, it was, you know, people always draw an analogy between the division of Korea and the division of Germany. I would say that the Germans had something to do with the fact that their country was divided. The Koreans did not. So June 25th, 1950, North Koreans come in. We have nobody there, basically. We bring in troops from Japan. Harry Truman says, we're not going to allow this to happen. Brings in troops from everywhere. We eventually get the North Koreans out of South Korea. They were about to have taken the whole peninsula were it not for U.S. troops. MacArthur does this famous landing in Incheon. For those of you who've been in Korea, you know that Incheon is the international airport there, and so an Incheon landing is not a very big deal these days, but for decades, the Incheon landing was one of the great military feats of modern time. 17-foot tides, brings in American troops, encircle the North Koreans, moves up, actually reaches the Yalu River. Chinese come in, drive us back. Again, back through Seoul, we stopped the Chinese in Osan, we go back up. It was a mess. It was truly a mess. But what do the North Koreans, what do they take from that? If it hadn't been for U.S. forces in South Korea, the peninsula would be unified. So for people who say, well, the North Koreans are totally irrational on their nuclear ambitions, after all, there's no purpose to their nuclear ambitions, there is a purpose. And what they're hoping is that if North Korea is allowed to be a nuclear country, the U.S., whether this president, the next president, the president after that, some American president will say, you know, do we really need to be on the Korean Peninsula? After all, the South Koreans ought to be able to handle this. Because if we're there, and there's some pushing and shoving that develops up on the DMZ, we could end up in a situation where the North Koreans could hold our civilians at risk, whether in Los Angeles or anywhere, frankly, with these new generation of solid fuel missiles they're developing. So the North Koreans are hoping that through development of a nuclear capability, they will create a circumstance where the U.S. sooner or later will weaken our tie to South Korea. And there are a lot of people who say, you know, the South Koreans, they can handle this. Why should we be there? So if you can imagine a situation where we're out of South Korea, well, we have another big troop commitment in Japan. which, by the way, I think is a very good thing to have troops there because it means influence in the region. And the Koreans and the Japanese, I think, treat our troops very well and do and pay a lot for, to have those troops there. But would Japan want to be the only place in the only country in the Pacific that has U.S. troops in it? If there's not, if there are not U.S. troops in Korea, would Japan say, well, all right, we'll be the only country in the Pacific? Remember why the U.S. troops came to Japan. They came as an occupying force. And we'll talk about a little about Iraq in a bit, but does Japan really want to have troops whose legacy was as an occupying force? Do they want to have them for the rest of time? Right now, if you poll Japanese on the subject, most of them are comfortable with U.S. troops. Would they be comfortable forever with U.S. troops? So let's, you know, this jumping on to hypothetical questions, but what if there are no U.S. troops in Japan? That would mean how is the U.S. going to defend our interests in the Western Pacific? And I would argue that if we don't have them in Korea and we don't have them in Japan, we become a lot less influential. And at the same time, I think we embolden what is today a kind of a very nationalistic and already emboldened China. So I think it's very important that we make it clear to the North Koreans we don't accept their nuclear ambitions. Now, it's funny because you get people, and I'm referring in particular to President Trump's previous national security advisor, John Bolton. And John Bolton would start every speech by saying, the North Koreans will never give up their nuclear ambitions. That's why we have to, you know, confront them with maximum force. That latter part of what he said is true, but the first part, when he said they'll never give up their nuclear force, that's what the North Koreans are listening to. And they think they can convince enough Americans to think, you know, this is really a fool's errand. We can't get them to give up their nuclear weapons. Therefore, we have to contain North Koreans' nuclear ambitions. Well, what does that mean, to contain? I understand what it meant with the Soviet Union in the 1940s. What does that mean, contain a country that already has nuclear weapons? I don't think it's an acceptable outcome. I think we need to make it very clear to the North Koreans we won't tolerate it, and we will try whatever we can to dissuade you from having them, and we have a lot of options to do it, but we do not have the option of walking away and saying this is not important. So I think the president had the right policy when with his first Secretary of State, Tillerson, where they worked very hard in the UN to make sure that Russia and China agreed with a program of kind of maximum sanctions. And these are really tough sanctions. For the first time, we got the Chinese to start limiting refined gasoline products to North Korea. I think it really has begun to hurt the North Korean economy. And I think to a great extent, that is why the North Koreans entered into negotiations with the U.S. So in some ways, it was a result of good policies that we had done. But then I think what happened in these negotiations, and again, I speak as a career diplomat, and I have certain techniques I feel that need to be applied. And the first is you should be very clear with the North Koreans what the goal of these talks are. I think there was a little too much showmanship in this and not enough workmanship in this. So what happened was, rather than have the usual thing where you have a diplomatic team meet the other country's team and say, we're very pleased that our leaders are going to meet next month, and we have put together a draft joint statement. We'd like you to have a look at this. Please take your time. We know you won't agree with all this, but if you can come back with your own draft, we can. And you start working on a draft joint statement so that when the two leaders meet, they can really spend time getting to know each other rather than haggling over wordsmithing of a joint statement. None of that happened in Singapore. None of that happened in Singapore. And so instead, we had a very vague commitment from the North Koreans indicating a desire to get rid of their nuclear weapons, but a sort of end-of-times desire to do so, as if when the lions lie down with the lambs, that's when we'll consider giving our... By the way, there's a museum in Israel, I don't know if any of you have seen it, where they have a lion lying down with a lamb. And I asked the curator, I said, how do you do that? And he said, well, we put a different lamb in every night. So this was what the North Koreans had in mind. And then following Singapore, well, the other thing that I felt the president needed to be better briefed. Whether it's the fault of his briefers or whether it's his fault for not listening, I can't really tell. But it is not acceptable to me to allow the North Koreans to say to the president, we would like, you know, we consider your exercises, they call them hostile war games with the South Koreans, a threat to us, and that is why we need nuclear weapons. The correct answer to that is, North Koreans, we understand you don't like our exercises with the South Koreans. We've been having them every year. Our only regret is we didn't have them before June 25th, 1950, because maybe if we had had them then, you wouldn't have taken the stupid decision to attack South Korea. That's the correct answer. You can take out the word stupid, but that is the correct answer. Instead, there was a sort of implication, okay, we'll suspend the exercises. It was a decision really meant to get the North Koreans to say, gee, they're serious about moving ahead on negotiation. But often when you're dealing with countries like North Korea, or in my experience dealing with, you know, places like not only North Korea, but the Bosnian Serbs and others, or dealing with Slobodan Milosevic, a nice gesture is often interpreted as a sign of weakness. And you got to be very careful about those gestures, unless you can tie something coming from in the other direction, tie it very tightly. So instead, the president said before his departure from Singapore, I don't like these, he called them hostile war games. They're not, they're joint military exercises. He said, I don't like them either, and they cost a lot of money. So I feel that we didn't move forward there. And then when the North Koreans refused to see our negotiator, a guy named Steve Biegun, for six months, I felt there was not sincerity, to use that word Sandy and I have heard many times in Asia, sincerity. I didn't feel the North Koreans were particularly sincere. And then we come around to the following February, which was almost a year ago, when the president met with the North Koreans in Hanoi. And the North Koreans laid out a proposal they would get rid of their main nuclear facility in Yongbyon. I've been to Yongbyon. It is a big, it's a nuclear reactor, and that's where they produce the plutonium for their nuclear weapons. Yongbyon, it sort of reminded me of a 1970s Romanian textile mill. I mean, in fact, it seemed to have the same coat of lime green paint on it. It must have been a sale that year in Eastern Europe. And it looked like the kind of place you'd want to get shut down and decommissioned as soon as possible. In fact, we did have it all. We had them stop producing from the reactor. We had them shut it down for some 10 years, and it's back up now. The president took the view, and the North Koreans asked for sanctions relief on this. I think the president was right to say to the North Koreans, we're not doing incremental amounts of sanctions. We're not going to give you sanctions relief on this until you do more, because we know they have other nuclear facilities, even though Yongbyon was the main one. So the president left after 5 hours, and they didn't pursue it. Now, you recall the North Koreans, which tells you something about the North Koreans. They had their, for a while, we thought their main negotiator had been not only exiled, but also executed. I don't think he's been executed, but we'll learn that at some point. But in short, I think the president should have said to the North Koreans, this is really interesting. I'm going to leave Mr. Biegun here, and he's going to work on this for however long it takes to see what it is you're going to do in building number one. There are about 80 buildings there. Well, building number one, building number two. I would have taken it more seriously. So, again, I don't feel there has been enough sort of diplomatic technology applied to this. I would stay with them. I would say to the North Koreans, okay, what are you going to do in this building? Oh, you will be happy. That was one of their favorite expressions. You will be happy. The correct answer is, I will determine when I'm happy, not you. And so you go, okay, what are you doing? Building four, building five, and just give them hell with by going through and asking specific questions. If they say, well, we're going to take a saw off these pipes, this kind of stuff we did under George W. Bush. By the way, George W. Bush, he'd ask this stuff. He said, well, what happened to the exhaust pipes? I said, well, we got them cut out of there. Okay, well, what about, you know, he knew this stuff. And I guess the point is, if you're going to deal with these issues, you've got to be at the 30,000-foot level. You have to, because Lord knows the president has a lot of other things he needs to do. But if this issue is one that you're going to define your presidency on, you better need a, you better develop a sense for a few details the way President Bush did. And I don't think there's been enough of that lately. So the U.S. left. The North Koreans were very disappointed. Essentially, we haven't had anything since. The president did take that quick walk into North Korea in Panmunjom, which is the so-called peace village in the so-called demilitarized zone, because there's not a zone that's more militarized in the world than that place. So, again, a nice gesture, and gestures are nice. Just remember, though, who you're gesturing to. And the North Koreans have a tendency of saying, that's a nice gesture, they must be weak. So be careful with that stuff. Think it through. Know what effect you're trying to produce when you do it. And don't just say, I'm going to make a gesture and I'm going to hope that they'll see it as such. So I guess I'm speaking as a former professional diplomat, where you everything, when you're dealing with a regime like that, you better be clear on what the thing it is that you're looking to get them to do. And there has not been enough clarity on that. I'll make one other point on that before I do want to shift and talk a little about Iraq right now. But one of the things that George W. Bush was very successful with, in my view, is when you went out as his envoy, he would make sure that everyone knew you were his envoy. I had the same experience with Barack Obama. When I went out to Iraq, I told the White House I'd like to see the president. They asked me how long I would like to meet with President Obama. I said 125th of a second will probably do, meaning I just wanted a picture so that when I got out to Baghdad, there'd be a picture of me in all the newspapers with the American president, and the Iraqis would say, ah, he really does talk to the president. We'll talk to him. George W. Bush did the same kind of stuff. This president needs to understand that this is not a one-man show. This is a whole team. It's a team sport. And the extent to which you can empower your negotiator extends your reach. It extends your ability to do things simultaneously in different parts of the world. Because people see the negotiator, oh yeah, I just saw him with the president the other day in the newspapers. That's the kind of stuff you have to think through. Ultimately, you'll be judged by how your team operates, not just how you operate. Or you'll be judged, as some presidents have been, great president, but terrible team, therefore terrible administration. So I think our current president needs to think a little more about that, because he needs to make accomplishments simultaneously in different parts of the world. Turning a little to Iraq, I must say, when I got out there and looked around, it was one of the most depressing scenes I've ever seen in my life. And I must say, when you serve there, you don't want to, and you've seen, you know, names on the wall of people we lost. I mean, one day I was, it was Memorial Day of all, and I gave a talk to the embassy staff in the morning, and we played Taps, which is, I think, one of the most haunting melodies you'll ever hear in the world. And then a few of our guys got into some cars and went up to Fallujah to have a look at a new water treatment facility that day. This was in Memorial Day in 2009. They never came back. One of the vehicles hit an improvised explosive device. It threw them up in the air 40 feet, and four of the five people in the car died, and three of them were Americans from the embassy. So these are terrible moments, And so when you serve there, you don't want to come back and say, this was all a terrible mistake. It's just not respectful to the families of those who died there. So you're kind of disinclined to do that. But what you do start thinking about is, how could we do this a lot better than we've been doing this? And I must say, one thing that we need to understand is that when we have elections in a place like Iraq, we should not be surprised if our candidate doesn't necessarily win. And we need to be prepared with the results of that election. I think every lawyer knows the old adage that you never ask a question unless you can live with the answer. An election is essentially a question, and you better be willing to work with people. So when I was there, a guy named Nouri al-Maliki, who was the prime minister, I spent a lot of time with him, and he had a... Iraq, to understand the basic math, you have 20% of the country is Kurdish, you have 60% Iraqi Shia, and you have 20% Iraqi Sunni. So Maliki, not surprisingly, was from the 60% Iraqi Shia, Shia Iraq. So just as Nelson Mandela took the issue of South Africa, where he had he also had a 20% problem, and that was the white South Africans who were ready to leave. Nelson Mandela reached out to them and did his best to make sure they felt that the future of South Africa was also going to be their future. So I, without invoking that analogy, I would talk to Maliki about that. But Nelson Mandela was one of the most charismatic figures in the world. And all I can say about Maliki is, if he ever had charisma, it cleared up a long time ago. And he did not understand this sort of need to do outreach. And so it's been increasingly a sort of Shia-led theocracy. Not the right direction for us, but one that we should have anticipated a little better than we did. So the issue is to try to get parties in Iraq to somehow look for issues. I mean, after all, there should be parties that want lower taxes or higher taxes, and they shouldn't all be divided in sectarian terms. But remember that when you go into a country and you take the whole civil structure of the country, in this case Saddam Hussein's civil structure, and you destroy it, don't be surprised if, rather than build a new civil structure, people take refuge in old structures. And in the case of Iraq, they took refuge in these old sectarian structures. So Shia were increasingly Shia, Sunni increasingly Sunni, and before you knew it, you had a very sectarian society. And one of the things that happened is, if you look at the Arab Middle East, you have all the countries are Sunni except for one, and that is Iraq. So lo and behold, the 20% Sunnis who live in Iraq, why they should be thinking, well, gee, we're only 20%. We should try to make common coalitions with some of these Shia parties and try to work more with the Shia. But no, they have felt that they consider it an indignity to work under the Shia. And so they feel that when they look at any other Arab country, which is a Sunni majority, they feel somehow entitled to a greater voice in Iraq than their 20% numbers would suggest. They have a certain strategic depth due to the fact that the whole Arab world is Sunni. So they've never really accepted the proposition they live under the Shia. And when you consider all the other countries, including Saudi Arabia, that has rejected the notion that somehow this Shia-led country should be around, remember, the Saudis are very worried about Shia, because where do they have a Shia majority? In their east province. And where do they have most of their oil? Also in their east province. So the Saudis have never been enthusiasts for this Iraq venture on our part. So we have a problem there, and lo and behold, the Iraqis have to some extent embraced the only other Shia power in the region. It's not Arab, it's Persian, and that is Iran. So the Iranians have been more influential in Iraq than they would otherwise have been. And don't forget that when there was the Iraq-Iran war, Saddam Hussein fought a war with a Sunni-led army, because Saddam Hussein was Sunni, of course. 80% of the rank and file of that army was Shia, and they fought bravely against the Shia from Iran. So it's not that the Shia in Iraq can't be trusted by other Arabs. I would say they're Iraqis first and Arabs second and Shia third. But don't be surprised that there is more Iranian influence, especially since the other other Arab Middle East countries have kind of rejected the new Iraq. So you have Iranians very active there, in particular Qasem Soleimani, very active in organizing these various Shia groups, the Shia militia, because, again, the state structures, such as the army, not very strong. We destroyed the army, and we've tried to build it up, but it takes time. In the meantime, you have these Shia militia groups. And so Qasem Soleimani provided a lot of assistance to them, and they, in turn, attacked Americans and killed many of us in the process. What is particularly upsetting about that, in addition to just the sheer loss of life, is the fact that we actually liberated these Shia. How in the world could they have this sense of somehow that we're the enemy? And again, the facile answer to that is, well, that's the Middle East. That's how it works there. But the fact is that it's a painful process that will take time. I mean, my motorcade, I was down in Nasiriya, which is a Shia town south of Baghdad. And I remember this was not my idea, by the way, but we had some journalists in the back showing how the American ambassador is now just doing typical stuff, visiting provinces and talking to people about how we can make the situation better. Within 20 minutes of leaving the provincial assembly hall, someone tried to blow up my car. Fortunately, the cell phone detonated bomb went off before my car was there, so it didn't kill me, but, you know, it was a pretty deafening explosion. Turned out to be one of these Shia groups supplied by Qasem Soleimani called the Promised Day Brigade. And so we realized this is a long-term haul. This is a long-term haul. So Qasem Soleimani, no question, he was a bad guy and a bad actor, and I certainly don't rue the day that we've taken him off the board. My concern, however, is what are we doing next, and how are we managing this crisis now? Iran is not to be confused with Iraq. Even though half the time people do. Iran is about three times larger. It's got three times the population. Qasem Soleimani has already been replaced by his deputy. He's not some stateless guy living in a cave. He was an Iranian general. This is a serious place to a serious end, and we better be careful about how we deal with this. We cannot allow Iran to have a nuclear weapon, and for that reason, it's been very important that we focus entirely on that. But at the same time, we need to understand that that country has been around for 4,000 years and is likely to be around for a lot longer. The idea that we can change the regime there, I have had many, many times when I want to change a regime. I mean, I would like every regime to be run by Red Sox fans, and we would have no problem. That is not the situation. You have to deal with the country, with the governments you get there. But we should not assume that the end of the mullahs is going to bring on some kind of more democratic and peaceful Iran. So I suggest we need something called a diplomatic track. Now, I know as a diplomat, I sound like the kid with a hammer who feels everything needs to be hit with a hammer. I do believe we need, when you talk about use of force can never be an end in itself. It needs a diplomatic complement to it. And we, as a country, are not doing enough diplomacy. We have essentially won the war in Syria against ISIS, but we have zero influence in Damascus, and Bashar al-Assad is still there, and yet we can't talk to him, and the Russians talk to him every day. How is that helping us in Syria if we don't have any connectivity to the people we may not like, but who are running Syria? So we, at the same time, the person running Iraq now, the prime minister there, he was around when I was around, and Adel Abdel Mehdi. We all liked Adel Abdel Mehdi. You'd walk into his office, he'd speak English, he was a World Bank economist, and you thought, wow, this is great, why can't he be prime minister? Well, Adel had about three supporters in the country, one of whom was his mother, and so he was not going to win the election. Instead, we got the charismatic Maliki as his as the person who won the election. So then Adel becomes prime minister because they ran out of other people. And sure enough, the press is already saying, "Well, Adel Abdel Mehdi, who's actually resigned as of now, and he's an interim prime minister. Well, Adel Abdel Mehdi, he's actually an Iranian stooge." Well, I'm sorry, you can't have it both ways, press. You can't call him the great savior as an English-speaking economist 10 years ago and now call him an Iranian stooge. We need to do a little better analysis than that kind of stuff. So I think with Iraq, we need to be engaged on this. We need to have good diplomats. We need to work with them, and we need to understand that they, at the end of the day, are going to make their decisions. So as we contemplate these issues, we do need to keep in mind that we have been facing this deep abyss, but let's not take that step forward. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ambassador Hill. Our first question for you comes from the students. What would you consider the most challenging aspect of your career? It seems you had a plenty.
Well, you know, you might think it was living in Iraq. You might think it was living in Bosnia. Frankly, it was the time in Washington, you know. And the big problem is, you know, you're up against these tough issues, and the last thing you want are people shooting at you from the rear. And I think there's way too much politics in American foreign policy right now. And it used to be there was this quaint idea that politics stops at the water's edge, but now it's like it just begins at the water's edge. And so you're out there trying to do a job for an administration, in my case for Obama or for Bush or for Clinton. I also worked for the senior Bush. And you're trying to do the best thing you can with the instructions you have, and then someone back in Washington is basically trying to eat you for lunch. And so I think the main issue is that if you're going to be out there doing things, you better have some friends back in Washington. You better have what we call top cover so that you don't have incoming in Washington. So.
Thank you. Will North Korea ever give up its nuclear weapons?
Well, you know, there are many people who say no to that question, and I say the proposition that we have to follow is the idea that they come around to the view that they have a better future without them than they do with them. Most countries don't have nuclear weapons because they've concluded correctly that they have a better future without them, and it's not acceptable for them to have nuclear weapons. We have to do a better job of making sure the North Koreans understand that theirs is a life of misery as long as they continue the pursuit of nuclear weapons. And what do I mean by misery? I mean, the idea is if they try to open up a bank account on the moon, we will bring out the Saturn V missile rocket and go to the moon and shut it down. We will not accept the proposition that they can have a normal existence. We need to isolate them diplomatically, something we've lost in the last year and a half, but we've got to be very tough on them. But at the same time, we have to extend the hand of negotiation, because if you don't have a negotiating track, you won't know when you've actually won.
Ambassador Hill, we got several questions like this. Ambassador William Burns has been very critical of the treatment of the Foreign Service in the last few years. What is your view of the current state of the Foreign Service and what needs to be done?
Bill Burns is a colleague of mine, extremely successful and really super foreign service officer. I think people should pay a lot of attention to the things he says about this. I think the Foreign Service has not been treated well in recent years. I think we have professional diplomats and the best in the world, and I think they ought to be allowed to do more things than they've been allowed to do in recent times. A lot of the ambassadorships that should be going to professional diplomats are not going to professional diplomats. And I think there's a real situation now where they are not in senior, we're not seeing very many professionals in senior positions. During my time, I was in meetings with the president. I know Bill Burns has been in meetings with the president, but lately that's not been the case. So I think it's a great national asset that we should be making far better use of. And when people complain about American diplomacy, they ought to understand that it's hard to do diplomacy without diplomats.
Ambassador Hill, please comment on China's One Belt, One Road that extends China's reach and influence, and two, China's activities in Africa and South America.
You know, opinions differ on that. I'll give you mine. I think China's interest in places like Africa, South America, frankly, Siberia, speaks to a foreign policy that's largely aimed at raw material acquisition. Not terribly inspiring stuff, but that's what they're doing. And they often do it to the detriment of the environment in these countries. And they pay for these raw materials, but I don't think it's a very, it's a particularly sustainable or long-term way to have a relationship. And certainly they've had a lot of problems with various governments in Africa, and deservedly so. The One Belt, One Road initiative, I think it's kind of breathtaking in the concept. It's essentially trying to say China needs to be joined in the way that Marco Polo envisioned China being joined to Europe. I mean, it's an effort really to stitch up and unite the Eastern Hemisphere. I don't see it. I see kind of excessive ambition in it. I see a lot of government use of finance, which is questionable. I mean, the efforts to, because they have a housing bubble there, they're investing in housing in other countries, and it sounds very kind of them to do it, except you see it has to do with fiscal imbalances than anything else. I don't think it's a concept of taking over the world, and I don't think we need to worry about that as some kind of overarching imperialistic project. I think it just speaks to the fact that China has a lot of internal problems, and these internal problems are being manifest in external activities, which are being understood by many people as external ambitions. I must say, I had a meeting at the Council on Foreign Relations in last October. I was hosting Mahathir, the Prime Minister of Malaysia, and I asked him what he did about this big China project in Malaysia. He said it was costing us too much money, so I told him we can't afford it, and I renegotiated it and made sure we didn't have Chinese workers there. We had Malaysian workers, and he said, from his point of view, the Chinese just wanted it as a project to employ more Chinese. And Mahathir said, no, we're not going to do that. We're not in charge of employing more Chinese. You do that, and you do that in your own country. So I think China has bought itself a lot of ill will with this kind of stuff. But I would caution against the idea that it's some kind of huge project aimed at a Chinese imperialist end, rather than a huge effort aimed at trying to ameliorate domestic problems that they have in their various imbalances.
Okay, last question. Does the advent of cyber operations change the calculus of the threat to the United States from China or North Korea?
You know, one of the things about cyber and about some of these technology issues around the world, is that is turning out to be very portable technology. And one of the things we saw just a couple of days ago with the Iranian Iranian missile attack on Al-Asad Air Base was they put those missile, they targeted precise, they hit precisely what their targets were. Except I hope they didn't mean to hit the Ukrainian airliner in Tehran. But in terms of the attack on the U.S. base, they knew exactly where they're putting their targets. I think we need to understand that there are very few rules of the road in cyber. And fortunately, I think our country tends to be ahead of other countries. But I don't think we can count on the on staying ahead. These are, in terms of technology, I think the Chinese are, if they're not at the same level we are, they're close to it. And I think there's a great deal to be concerned about. And I think it's kind of the next field where we're going to have some negotiations over, with the understanding that it's going to be very hard to negotiate because you can't count missile silos or the sorts of things we could do in previous arms control. It's going to be very difficult to assess or to have any notion that you know what the other side is really doing and they're abiding by agreements. So I think it's probably the greatest challenge we have ahead of us. And if there are any agreements, the issue of verification is going to be absolutely huge. And I don't think there are any answers to that. The answer is to have better relations with countries and a commitment to a common future so that no one will want to disrupt that common future. And if you make a country an enemy, or if you consider a country an enemy, you may be sort of creating a self-fulfilling prophecy. And so I think the solution is rooted in a common future and better relations. But I have no easy answers on cyber, and I think it's something that our children and our children's children are going to be hearing a lot about.
Ambassador Hill. Thank you ever so much for a fantastic speech and your enlightening comments. We very much appreciate your being here.
Thank you.
All right, that was great.